This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening and welcome to the Jeffrey V. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science Speaker Series. My name is Cheryl Peach and I'm a program scientist here at the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, UC San Diego. It's really a pleasure to have you all here this evening. It's also my great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Phil Hastings. He's a professor of marine biology, but he's also the curator of the Marine Vertebrates Collection here at Scripps, better known by the less accurate name of the Fish Collections. His research is really quite varied. It spans the range from the behavioral ecology of fishes to marine conservation and lots of things in between. But tonight, we're very fortunate to have Phil here in his capacity as one of the world's foremost experts on the systematics and diversity and evolution of fishes. His passion for this subject is really born out of a long-time dedication to the subject and also a long history of teaching undergraduate and graduate students. It really embodies his dedication to the science. And along with his co-authors, H.J. Walker and Grant Galland, they have created a book dedicated to this topic, Fishes, A Guide to Their Diversity. I hope you all had a chance to see that and perhaps even purchase a copy. But I'd like you to please take a moment and just give a warm welcome to Phil for his talk titled The Amazing Diversity of Fishes. Phil, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Cheryl. I very much appreciate that, and I appreciate the invitation to come and speak here. And also thanks to all of you for coming this evening. It's really quite an amazing turnout. As I said to someone, this is bespeaks the love of people have for fishes and less so for the authors of the book. So what I'm going to try to do tonight and what we do in our book is cover the entire diversity of fishes of the world. And it's a rather daunting task, given the diversity of fishes. And so what I want to, that's one point I'll make over and over again tonight in the talk. But let's start out with just a very simple question. So think in your mind, well, what is a fish? How do you define a fish? And most of you know they have vertebrae. You can see the vertebral column on this one, this x-ray of the beautiful butterfly fish. They have jaws, typically. They have scales, typically. They generally have gills, and they generally live in the water. But as it turns out, this doesn't actually apply to all fishes, and there are exceptions to almost all of these characteristics. And so it's not easily defined because it's not what we call a monophyletic group, which is an ancestor and all of its descendants. But you can think of them as vertebrates that have gills that, for, at least for part of much, most of their lifetime, most of them live in water. And this is the major lineages of fishes, and I'm going to go through these in some detail. It includes the jawless fishes as well as a group of jawed fishes. The chondrichthyans are in this group, which include the cartilaginous fishes, the lobe-fin fishes, and then the ray-fin fishes. So before I do that, I want to just give you a brief overview of the global diversity of fishes. And as you can see from this slide, fishes are divided into four classes. There's 82 orders of fishes distributed among about 515 families. And the current total number of species of fishes described, valid described species, is over 33,000 species. Contrast this with the diversity of tetrapods, and I'm sure you all know the tetrapods include all the amphibians, the frogs and salamanders, the reptiles, snakes, turtles, etc., birds and mammals, which fall short of this number by several thousand. So if you just contemplate the diversity of tetrapods, everything from a frog to a bird to your dog at home, imagine that equivalent diversity that we're going to have to cover here tonight in fishes. The systematics of fishes is still under study, and there likely are well over 35,000 species. It's been predicted that that number, and my guess is it's going to go quite a bit higher than that. And here's some evidence of that. This is actually a compendium published by the Catalog of Fishes, which is a website that keeps track of fish descriptions and fish names. And what you can see is that in the last 20 years, over 7,000 species of fishes have been newly described to science. And this number per year ranges from about 200 species per year to well over 500. And that trend continues even today through 2014. And as of yesterday, 138 have been named in 2015. So that's actually really exciting to someone like myself, who's a systematic ichthyologist. It means we still have a lot of work to do, and it's a really a vibrant science that if we, there's just a lot of work to do. Another issue that comes to bear on this diversity of fishes at the species level is, what do you call a species? And we don't have time to discuss that in any detail tonight, but I just want to give you an appreciation for how species concepts can change and how that actually affects our views of diversity. So you guys are probably all familiar with the salmonids, or the trout and salmon. You may have had one for dinner last night. In 10 years ago, there were 66 valid species recognized. Since that time, there's been quite a lot of genetic data gathered on this group, because it's commercially important and many populations are endangered. And based on that genetic information, the number of species has actually more than tripled in the last 10 years. And it's not that we've discovered new populations of trouts or salmon, it's that we've understood more about their diversification and hence recognizing more and more species. It's a really important point is that this level of genetic analysis has really not been applied to very many groups of fishes. So as time goes on, I think we're going to see, and as more and more genetic data become available, we'll see the known diversity of fishes increasing considerably. So I've been challenged in teaching. I teach a class in ichthyology or biology of fishes where we cover this diversity, and obviously groups like this event tonight, and also the mission of the Birch Aquarium is to convey some information about this extraordinary diversity. This is a global map that shows collecting events of fish specimens that are archived in the collection, which I'm fortunate enough to be the curator of this collection. This is really one of the leading collections in the world, particularly for oceanic fishes. And it includes something like 26,000 collecting events with emphasis on both the tropical Eastern Pacific from Alaska to Chile, but then globally for oceanic fishes. There are collections or specimens in the collection that date back well over 100 years. And it includes about 111,000 lots of fishes. Those are jars of fishes. And they're archived in Vaughan Hall down on the campus here at Scripps. We have about 2 million specimens of fishes archived, representing almost 6,000 species. And importantly, for our perspective here of trying to cover this broad diversity of fishes, the Scripps collection has representatives of almost all of the families of fishes in the world. The ones that we don't have well represented are freshwater fishes, particularly catfishes and tetras, as we'll see in just a moment. So it's really quite an extraordinary resource. Two former curators were largely responsible for building this collection, and I very much stand on their shoulders. They're really quite extraordinary men. Carl Hubbs initiated the collection in 1944 when he arrived at Scripps. He hired Richard Rosenblatt, who was here for his entire career as curator of fishes at Scripps. And these two researchers were extraordinarily knowledgeable about the diversity of fishes. And I remember giving my first talk as a graduate student and having the two of them in the audience, and I was actually quite intimidated by seeing them in the front row. But they both believe very strongly in collection building, and others are much the better for their efforts. Okay, so let's start our survey of fishes then. I mentioned that they are vertebrates. In fact, they are in the lineage of the vertebrata, which are characterized by a vertebral column, which this is a shark vertebrae. And the vertebral column is actually a structure that provides support to the body, but also provides protection for the spinal cord. And as we begin going up the tree, the first group off the tree are the anatha, which literally means no jaws. And so these are the jawless fishes. The jawless fishes include two groups. The first of these is the myxiniforms, or the hagfishes. And it's not a very attractive name, and they're actually not very attractive fishes. But they're quite interesting. And it turns out Scripps, partly because of Dr. Hubbs, has, I'm certain, the world's largest collection of hagfishes. And they all look more or less like this one. They're, despite being 76 species, they're morphologically fairly uniform. But they're interesting in that they have a series of barbels around the mouth. And while they don't have jaws, they do have these sort of rasping plates that are made of chitin. And these this group of fishes are scavengers. They're strictly marine fishes occurring in the deep ocean, largely. You can collect them here in the Scripps Canyon. But they're important scavengers in the deep sea. So when a marine mammal or whale dies, the hagfishes are one of the first things to get to it to begin feeding on it. The other lineage of the jawless fishes are the lampreys, or the Petromyzontiformes. They're eel-like, like elongate fishes, like the hagfishes, but they lack the barbels around the mouth, and instead they have a series of rasping teeth around this oral disc. This group is pretty broadly distributed, again, worldwide in distribution, but it occurs in a variety of habitats, ranging from freshwater to coastal areas. And it's an interesting group for a lot of reasons. We don't have time to go into the details of the biology of these groups in any great detail. But these are particularly interesting because they occur in fresh waters, and some of the species are anadromous. That is, they spawn in fresh water, and the adults move their way out into either a large lake or coastal areas where they develop. It also includes some parasitic species that actually attach themselves to other fishes, and by sort of rasping away at flesh are able to make a living parasitizing other fishes. And you may be familiar with the sort of tragedy of these marine lampreys colonizing the Great Lakes region once we cut all those shipping canals through from the ocean all the way through, connecting all the way to Lake Superior. It was a very distinct progression of invasion of the marine lamprey into the Great Lakes region that followed those canals very, very precisely, and actually had very significant negative impacts on the fisheries in those lakes. So those are the jawless fishes, their sister group, as we say. In other words, the lineage that is most closely related to them are called the Nathostomata, which literally means jawed mouth. And here's a nathostome here. It's hard to pick out sort of which nathostome to put up there, but a lion works well. The first lineage of the nathostomes that I want to discuss are the Chondrichthyan fishes, and these are familiar to lots of you. This includes the sharks and the rays, but it also includes another group, the chimeras here, which are quite an interesting group. The Chondrichthyan fishes have a skeleton entirely of cartilage, as opposed to the bony fishes, which we'll see in a moment, that have a skeleton largely of bone in most cases. And the cartilaginous fishes include a fairly large diversity, about 1,200 species distributed among 14 orders and 45 families. So it's really quite a diverse group, an interesting group too. The first lineage are the chimeras, or sometimes called rat fishes, because they actually look not unlike a rat. They're really quite an interesting group. They generally occur on continental shelves and continental slope areas. And they're worldwide in distribution and found in marine waters. And they're particularly interesting for a number of reasons. They have a small ventral mouth, and they have crushing teeth, so they're able to feed on clams and hard-bodied prey like that. But one of the most interesting features is this process on the snout of males. And what I didn't mention is the Chondrichthyan fishes all have internal fertilization. So males actually have a copulatory organ we call a clasper. It's usually associated with the pelvic fin back here, and it's used to transmit sperm to the female. These guys have a regular pelvic fin clasper, but they also have an unusual feature on the snout. And it's actually thought that this facilitates copulation in these guys. It's really quite an extraordinary group. And they actually use this structure where it has teeth on it to grasp grasp the fin of the female. So that's the chimeras. The next group in the cartilaginous fishes are the elasmobranchs, which is a group, a lineage that includes the sharks and the rays. And so these are what we more typically think of as cartilaginous or chondrichthyan fishes. And starting with the sharks, they're comparable in diversity to the rays. There's something like 500 plus species of sharks distributed among 35 families. So that sort of tells you there's a lot of morphological variation within the group. And I'm just going to show you some examples of a few members of the shark group, the Selachii, it's called. And one of these is the Heterodontiformes, which are called, or the horn sharks. It's not a very diverse group. There's only 9 species, and they're all morphologically fairly similar, although they're entirely marine. Interestingly, they're found in the Indian and Pacific Oceans, but there are no extant species in the Atlantic. But this species is common off our coast here, and in fact, you can see horn sharks in the aquarium here. I'm pretty sure there's still one in the kelp tank back there. They're interesting in that they have modified structures, fin elements here that are spine-like in front of the two dorsal fin spines. It's also an interesting group in that their feeding behavior is not unlike the chimeras. They have a small mouth, and they have their jaws are comprised of very hard, crushing tooth-like structures for crunching up hard-bodied prey. So definitely have a look around the aquarium, and you should see some of these guys in the aquarium. What you more typically think of as a cartilaginous fish or chondrichthyan fishes are the ground sharks or the Carcharhinoformes. This is a very diverse group, nearly 300 species of carcharhinids, and they're obviously worldwide in distribution, widely found in marine settings, but there's a few species that are fresh water. And here's a great story that bull sharks have actually been collected in Ohio. Not recently, but several decades ago, there were reports of bull sharks making their way all the way up the Mississippi River. It includes a number of things, again, very common species that we see. The aquarium here displays a number of leopard sharks. It's quite common in our area. And Andy Nozel, who's a postdoc here funded by the Birch Aquarium, has actually been studying the leopard shark aggregations here in La Jolla. And he's got some really interesting information about these guys. If you haven't seen the shark aggregation, the leopard shark aggregation, I encourage you to go snorkeling on the southern end of La Jolla Shores Beach beginning about July, August, and into September. It's really quite phenomenal. Adults will come right into the shallow areas of only 1 or 2 meters depth. And in fact, the Birch leads shark walks, I think, regularly down to that area if you would like to go with a guide. The Carcharhinoforms also include a number of predatory sharks. Like this is a tiger shark. It's a juvenile, but actually, if you know sharks at all, tiger sharks get really large. They're voracious predators. But the common name comes from this mottled coloring they have on their body. And also includes these very bizarre hammerhead sharks, which have the anterior head sort of flattened and broad and expanded outward with the eyes sort of out at the tips of these this hammer-like structure. Very, very unusual fishes. I can't talk about sharks without mentioning the lamniforms, or they're called the mackerel sharks. And this is a really diverse group. There's only 15 species, but they're distributed in 7 families. And what that tells you is that each of these species tend to be very sort of morphologically very distinctive. It includes things like the mako sharks, which are fast-swimming predatory fishes in the epipelagic zone. It includes the thresher sharks, like the Salopius, with this incredibly elongate dorsal half of the caudal fin, which is actually used to stun prey. As they swim through schools of herring, they whip this tail side to side, stun the prey, and then come back around and pick them up. This group includes the great white shark, which of great movie fame. But it also includes some other deep water sharks. And here's some from our collection. This is called a crocodile shark. It's a very unusual, very rare shark. Doesn't show up in very many collections. Few people have seen one. But it's dark in color, has a big eye. Also includes the megamouth shark, which is just recently discovered, an entire family of sharks discovered about 40 years ago. They're really unusual mesopelagic fishes that actually feed on plankton in the mesopelagic zone. And they've been taken right off our coast here, off Catalina Island. And then this last one is a sort of flaccid specimen, maybe not the best specimen in the world, of a goblin shark, but a very, very rare fish. One last group of sharks I'm going to mention are the squaliforms, they're called. And these are worldwide. Shallow water includes the spiny dogfish, which is a really slow-growing fish, but it's heavily exploited by fisheries. If you ever were in England and ate fish and chips, originally the fish was a codfish, and once the cod fishery collapsed, the industry switched to feeding people spiny dogfish and chips, which doesn't sound quite as good. And unfortunately, since that time, this fishery has collapsed too because they're heavily overfished. So your guess is as good as mine as what you get with a fish and chips dinner in London. The dogfish sharks include some really cool things that are mesopelagic that occur in the open ocean but in very deep water. This is actually a kite fin shark here. And you can tell by its dark coloration that it's actually a mesopelagic fish is occurring in very deep water. This group often has luminous organs, so this tissue here on the anal fin probably produces light. They have light organs along the body. And they typically, a number of species get no larger than 6 or 8 inches as full-grown adults. It's really quite an extraordinary group. The group also includes another really bizarre fish, the cookie cutter shark. This is another oceanic shark that has very unusual mouth with the teeth are modified basically like a cookie cutter. And this fish makes a living by swimming up to large fishes and also marine mammals, whales and porpoises, and taking a divot out of their side. In fact, this inset here is the side of an oarfish that washed up recently in Southern California with these scars on it made from cookie cutter sharks. Very unusual way to make a living. So those are the dogfish sharks. Quickly moving on to the rays. The rays are actually a monophyletic group. All the members are closely related, descendant from a common ancestor. And they have a couple of really distinctive features. So they're dorsoventrally flattened. So they're not laterally compressed. They're dorsoventrally flattened. And their eyes are on the upper surface of the body. And the lower surface of the body has the mouth and the gill slits. And so in addition to that sort of orientation, they also have the pectoral fins, which is this big fin here, is actually contiguous with the head. So here's an x-ray of a ray. And this is the spinal cord, the snout is here, the gill slits are here, and this is the pelvic fin, the one in the back here. But this line here is the support for the pectoral fin, which you can see the fin rays actually extend all the way out on the edge of this of the wings or pectoral fins of this fish. So that's characteristic of the rays. Rays are quite common. In fact, quite common here in La Jolla. The Rajaformes, or the skates, are one lineage of almost 360 plus species. They're worldwide marine fishes. And this is one of our local fishes, the guitar fish. It's actually quite common here in La Jolla. And if you snorkel in the summer, snorkel out just beyond the surf zone, you'll likely see quite a number of these guitar fishes. These are completely harmless fishes. They don't have stinging spines. Unlike the true stingrays, which are in the Myliobataformes. And these guys vary a lot in shape, but they do have this one feature, which is on the base of the tail fin, they have a modified spine that's actually venomous. About 220 species worldwide, and they occur in a variety of habitats, from marine waters just off here to this species, which is actually endemic, found only in the Amazon basin. So some live their entire life in fresh water. It includes our round stingray, again, which is quite common here. And if you run around on the beach here into the shallow surf zone, you may well step on one of these. This genus, Urobatus, is actually responsible for almost all of the stingray spining of events that happen here in La Jolla. So it's really interesting fishes, but kind of problematic for the lifeguards. The stingrays also include some pelagic members, and so this is really quite a diverse group, things that sit on the bottom, but then there are a number of groups of of stingrays that actually are pelagic. So the bat rays and the manta rays are actually descendant from ancestors that of this group, and they actually still retain a stinging spine, although it's quite small in these. All right, so let's move on to the bony fishes, or the osteichthyes, and unlike the cartilaginous fishes, their skeleton is made of true bone. And we'll start by looking at the lobe fin fishes, which are called the sarcopterygii. And these guys are all characterized by a paired fins, pectoral and pelvic fin, but they have a central axis of bone that goes down the length of the fin. And the sort of classic member of this is the coelacanth. So if you looked at the bone structure here, there's a series of bones that are large here, and they decrease in size as you move outward on the fin, and then the fin rays are aligned on the edge of that. That's actually homologous to our arm with our humerus bones here, and then increasing numbers of bones as we move out on the tips of our arms. This is an incredibly fascinating group, only two living species. It was thought to be extinct, and in fact, there's a good fossil record for coelacanths, but the most recent known fossil dates back to about 80 million years, and so it was thought to be an extinct group. But the first one of these was discovered in 1938 in the Western Indian Ocean off South Africa. And since that time, a second living species has been discovered in Indonesia. And we could give a whole talk on coelacanths, but we really don't have time to do that tonight. But it's a really fascinating group. Also in the sarcopterygii are the lungfishes, or the ceratodontiformes. And as the name implies, they're air breathers. And these guys are found in the southern continents. There's a species in Australia, one in South America, and then a few in Africa. It's an important group evolutionarily because they actually are the closest relative to the tetrapods, or the four-limbed vertebrates, which include the amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals. So it's evolutionarily quite an interesting group. So the osteichthyes, then, the bony fishes, includes the sarcopterygii as well as the ray fin fishes, which we'll get to in just a second. But the sarcopterygii, this lineage, actually includes the tetrapods. And you and I are both tetrapods. And in fact, you and I, because of that, we're members of the osteichthyes clade, which means we're bony fishes by definition. So this fact is actually really a compelling argument about the evolutionary history of life and evolutionary history of vertebrates. And in fact, it led to Neil Shubin writing this book called Your Inner Fish. It's a popular account of the evolutionary biology and evolutionary morphology of these fishes and how they led to the tetrapods and ultimately to the human body. So I encourage you to read that book if you haven't seen it before. Our friend Ray Troll, who's a really wonderful artist, very adept at illustrating evolutionary concepts, did this sort of after this book came out, called Chucky D, which is Charles Ernest says, Embrace Your Inner Fish. And then Ray also did this one that says, Mom is here. So you and I are bony fishes. You go home and tell your kids that. They'll get a kick out of it. So moving on up the tree, the sister group to the tetrapods is actually the actinopterygii, or they're called the ray fin fishes, and they have unique pectoral fin supports that differ from those in the sarcopterygians. This is a gigantic group, 64 orders, 450 plus families, and over 32,000 species. It's really quite a diverse group. Here's a recently published phylogeny for the group, and I'm not going to go through this in any detail, but I just wanted to show you, make a couple of points. This is based on molecular data and looking at a variety of selected members of the Actinopterygii. It's really hard to study the evolution of a group that has 32,000 species in it. It's really quite challenging, and so you have to pick representatives to collect data for. But let's look in a little bit more detail, and starting with these early lineages here, there's several lineages here that are actually low species diversity lineages, not a lot of species there, but they've been studied a lot because they're evolutionarily very interesting, because they in some ways have features that imply the transition to this amazing radiation of ray fin fishes. And here are some of those guys, and you may or may not know some of these. The Bashirs, the polypterids, are found in the freshwaters of Africa. They're actually able to breathe air. This early lineages also include the sturgeons, which are really important commercial fishes that have been overfished, unfortunately, in a lot of areas because of exploitation for their caviar or their eggs. Related to the sturgeon fishes are the paddle fishes, which is a really unusual group. Only two living species in the world, one in the Mississippi River drainage and one in the Yangtze River. And they're unusual because they're planktivores. It doesn't use it to dig in the sediment. It actually looks like it's an antenna, basically, that helps it detect prey items coming towards it. And then also one of these earlier lineages include the gars and the bowfins, which are really voracious predators in the waters, fresh waters and estuarine waters of North America and Cuba. But the real diversity in the ray fin fishes lies in the teleostei, which is at this node in the tree. And this basically includes 96% of all species of fishes known, living fishes known today, the teleostei. This is the point when I teach ichthyology where I put this slide up and my whole class groans, because we spent all this time studying all the morphology and all the diversity, and only 4% of the diversity, and look what's coming. And you may well groan as well. But I will try to get through this in due course here this evening. So the teleosts are really, really quite an amazingly diverse group. I thought to deal with this diversity, instead of going through the tree, which I actually do in my class, I would talk about habitats and sort of some representative groups of ray fin fishes that live in various habitats. So what do you think would be the diversity of fishes in marine versus fresh waters? The marine realm is really large. Fresh waters are fairly restricted, particularly here in Southern California, but not in the rest of the world. And out of this 32,000 species, it turns out 43% of them are actually freshwater species, limited to fresh waters. And that's really surprising because the actual freestanding fresh water in the world accounts for only about 1% of the open freestanding water or aquatic habitats in the globe. But this incredible diversity is because they don't disperse well, because they tend to get isolated in individual river basins or streams or lakes, et cetera. And so their speciation rate and accumulation of species seems to be very, very rapid compared to comparable marine fishes. So marine teleosts then are largely the balance of this, about 57% of about 18,000 species. Let's look really briefly. I know we're at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, but I actually study some freshwater fishes as well, and I think they're really interesting. It turns out about two-thirds of the global freshwater fish species diversity is in a single lineage that is an ancestor in all of its descendants. We call that lineage the Otophysi. And it includes these four orders of fishes, the cypriniforms, gymnotiforms, carassiforms, and siluriforms. So this is really phenomenal that this one lineage here actually represents basically two-thirds of freshwater fish diversity on a global basis. So I'll just show you representatives of these. The cypriniforms are the carps and their relatives. You can see the features here. Obviously, I'm not going through these, but these are listed in the book as well. But this group includes all greater than 4,000 species of freshwater fishes found in North America, Eurasia, and Africa. And interestingly, this whole lineage is not present in South America. It includes some things you all know, like the goldfish that you might have had as a child, or maybe you still do. And then a number of other interesting things like barbs and also loaches, et cetera. Really, really incredibly diverse group. One of our local, or at least North American families, is the Cyprinidae, with almost 3,000 species. And this number continually goes up. People describe new species quite regularly. This group is found in North America, Eurasia, and Africa. And if you go to any sort of stream, particularly in the eastern U.S., east of the Rockies, the minnows you see in the stream are members of the cyprinids for the most part. An almost equally diverse group with what 1,700 species are the carassins or the tetras. And this is an amazingly morphologically diverse group, restricted to the waters of South America and Africa, with a couple of species that make their way into North America. There's one called the Texas tetra here. It's commonly seen. If you go into any aquarium shop in San Diego or anywhere else, you're going to see members of the Carassiformes. They do very well in slow-moving water, so they adapt well to aquaria. It includes things like the neon tetras, etc. And then there's some more infamous fishes like the piranhas are also included in this group as well. But it's an amazingly morphologically diverse group with aggressive predators, some more sort of fast-swimming predators, some deep-bodied things that feed on small prey, even some cave fishes that have lost eyes and pigment. So that's the carassins. The last group that I'm going to talk about for the otophysi are the siluriformes, or the catfishes. You guys all have a visual image of a catfish because they have barbels. They have these little projections, fleshy projections off the snout, and they number from 2 to 4 pairs of these, or 2 to 3 pairs, excuse me. The group is enormously diverse, and look at the diversity here. There's greater than 3,000 species and in 35 families of catfishes. So, and this diversity is worldwide. They're found in South America, North America, Europe, and Asia. So really an amazingly diverse group of successful fishes. Most of those are in freshwaters, but it turns out there are two families that are marine, and this is the most specious one, the sea catfishes. And if you've ever been fishing in the tropics, it's not uncommon to catch one of these. They're actually quite common and quite important predators in coastal areas of the tropics. Before I leave freshwater fishes, I just wanted to mention a couple of other groups that are common in freshwater in addition to the otophysi. One are the perches, the Persidae. This is well over 200 species that are common in streams and lakes of temperate waters. They're often, the northern species are often consumed by people. So this is a walleye here that some of you may have eaten if you've been up in the Midwest. And many of the species are really brightly colored. The darters, for instance, live benthically in streams and can be incredibly beautifully colored. You're probably more familiar with the centrarchids or the freshwater sunfishes. These guys include the largemouth bass, which has been introduced around the world, and these are obviously important for recreational fisheries on a global basis. Another largely freshwater group are the cichlids, and I mention these just because of the enormous diversity, and it's a kind of a controversial group that different recent authors have argued that there are somewhere between 1,300 and 3,000 species. So this is largely an issue of species definition, but it's a really important group. Found in South America, one species get the Texas cichlid, actually makes it into the U.S., found in Africa and India, and then tilapia. You may have all seen tilapia on menus locally. It's introduced worldwide for aquaculture. And again, any aquarium shop you go into is going to have cichlid fishes in it. Moving on a bit to the marine component of ray fin fishes. So this series of data here just show you the sort of relative diversity for different habitats. So the shallow tropical waters, so coastal areas and the warm tropical areas, have about 40% of the ray fin fishes. Compared that to shallow temperate areas, such as our coastline and north of us, only about a little over 5%. The epipelagic zone, the open ocean, has about 1% of that. The deep pelagic, about 5% of the total species. And deep benthic, things on the bottom, about a little over 6%. So I'll just show you some examples of some fishes from some of these areas. In terms of shallow water coastal, largely tropical groups. And I should add a caveat here that a lot of these groups, for the anchovies are a perfect example, occur in the tropics and also in the temperate areas. So these would fall into both categories. But anchovies are important fishes. They're planktivorous. They have a pretty big mouth and a large eye and a little unusually pointed rostrum. They're worldwide, often entering fresh water. And this is actually, anchovies actually support the largest commercial fisheries in the world, especially the Peruvian anchoveta fishery off South America. Very important group. Closely related to them are the herrings, which you've probably all been aware of. There's some in the tank right behind us in this room. Almost 200 species of herrings. They're worldwide occurring. Some species are endemic to freshwater habitats as well. These also support a significant number of commercial fisheries, and it's also an important group because they actually feed pretty low on the trophic scale, feeding either on copepods, zooplankton, and in some cases actually phytoplankton. So these are environmentally friendly fishes. If you're looking for an environmentally responsible way to eat fishes, herrings and anchovies are actually a really good bet. It's a little plug for our local sardine fisheries, which unfortunately are not doing well at the moment, but that's another story. And then, so I was really struggling this weekend with kind of how to cover the rest of the diversity, and so I'm just going to throw out a few things here. A couple of my favorites. One of these is the porgies, the sperids. These are a worldwide marine group, and they're particularly interesting because they have a number of herbivorous species and some that feed on really heavy body invertebrates. So this is the lower jaw. Actually, this is a lower jaw from a porgy, which are actually able, they feed on bivalves, et cetera. They or barnacles in some cases. They rip them off the rock and are able to crush them with their molars, very much like molars of people. You guys all know flatfishes. These are really an unusual group of almost 700 species of fishes. They're actually lying on their side, and they're the only group of vertebrates that have eyes on one side of their head and then a completely blind side. They support lots and lots of commercial fisheries, and they occur in the very deepest parts of the ocean all the way up into fresh waters. So a really amazing diversification of flatfishes. I can't talk about marine fishes without mentioning the gobies. The gobies are small benthic fishes, 1,700 or so species, and commonly seen in all habitats worldwide except the deep sea. And it includes some really unusual things like the blind goby here, which is actually can be caught here in La Jolla. If you pick up overturned rocks in the intertidal and look inside ghost shrimp burrows, this completely blind fish actually lives inside the burrow, apparently never leaving it as an adult. So this specimen was actually collected here in La Jolla. I have to mention the eels. The true eels are anguilliforms, and they all are characterized by this unusual larval type. This is a larval eel. It's called a leptocephalus. It's very thin, laterally compressed, oceanic species. It doesn't look much like the adults, but moray eels are an example of the eels that are worldwide in distribution. So I thought I ought to take a little step back real briefly here and talk about why tropical coastal fishes diversity is so high. And you guys all know there's a latitudinal gradient. If you go on any habitat in the temperate area versus the tropics, there's many more species in the tropics. So that takes care of this tropical diversity component of this. But for marine organisms, there's actually something we call a longitudinal gradient. And that is that if you go around the Earth, there are actually areas where diversity is particularly high. And it's highest in what's called the Coral Triangle of the Indo-Pacific. And here's just an example of that. Here is a damselfish. This is one of the anemone fishes. It's in the same family as our Garibaldi and blacksmith that occur out here. And what's shown here is the number of species that occur in each of these regions. And so if you look at this area here, south of the Philippines, with it includes Borneo and Indonesia, there's like 110 species of damselfishes in that one area. And as you go outward on the Pacific plate, the number declines until there's only about 15 damselfishes in Hawaii. If you look more carefully, more closely, there's a paper by Jerry Allen at diversity of fishes that occur in each one of these little rectangles that he drew here for Borneo, again, Borneo, New Guinea, etc. You can see the number of coral, this is just coral reef fishes, can be upwards of 1,700 species in one area. Just to give you a comparison, you guys have probably, many of you have been diving in the Caribbean, the total number of reef fishes in the Caribbean is only a little over 400. The total reef fishes is not quite 400 in the tropical eastern Pacific. And our kelp forest, which is actually a beautiful habitat and looks very diverse, actually has about 50 species that you commonly see. So the comparison here of getting in the water where there's 1,500 species versus 50 species, is it's really an awe-inspiring area. And this, again, this is where the bulk of coastal diversity for fishes and for many other marine groups lies. So just quickly, I'm just going to quickly go through several reef groups. The wrasses are quite a diverse, over 600 species worldwide, common and quite diverse on coral reefs. We have a number of species here in the kelp forest in La Jolla as well. Here are the damsel fishes. This is a faded out anemone fish, Nemo here without any color. It includes a variety of almost 400 species commonly seen on coral reefs. Cardinal fishes are nocturnal planktivores on coral reefs, 350 or so species of these. Again, worldwide marine and common on coral reefs. Some more charismatic ones that you probably are more familiar with, or maybe are the butterfly fishes, incredibly beautiful fishes, often seen as pairs on coral reefs. Very conspicuous. Also closely related to the angel fishes, which are distinguished from them by this having this projection on the preopercle here. I have to mention the synathiforms, the pipe fishes and their relatives, in part because the Birch Aquarium has been a real advocate for this group. And you can see representatives of a number of these shrimp fishes, et cetera, in the tanks here behind me. I encourage you to get out and look at those. The group includes the better known pipefishes and seahorses and the leafy, the dragonfishes as well. Really quite a phenomenal group and a special focus of research and conservation efforts here at the Birch Aquarium. I have to mention this group, the Bleniiforms. It's the one I'm one of the world's experts on. They're small fishes, benthic fishes, but nearly 900 or so species worldwide. So, but in general, they all sit on the bottom. And then one sort of other group I thought I would mention are the tetraodontiforms. They have this unusual name called Plectinas. That's an old name, but 10 families of these include some fairly bizarre things you've never seen before, but also some fairly well-known fishes like the puffers, the tetraodontiforms. And these guys are characteristic of being able to inflate their body by basically what they do is they swallow water into their stomach, which expands their abdominal cavity, and then when they're, and that's to thwart predators, they then just expel the water back out the mouth. And these guys are found in a variety of habitats, from coral reefs, but also there's some freshwater species as well, and even an epipelagic lineage of puffer fishes. And this is where the fugu here actually resides, the one that is has toxic organs but is eaten in Japan. The tetraodontiforms includes the trigger fishes, which are an interesting group because their name trigger derives from this dorsal fin spine that's actually able to be locked in the erect position by inserting, there's a muscle that allows it to pull the second spine in behind the first spine to erect it up, which again potentially thwarts predators. Closely related to them are the file fishes, which have a similar feature in the dorsal fin. But generally smaller scales. The box fishes, or the ostraceas, they basically have a body encased in very hard fused scales. Very slow swimmers, but they get away with that because they actually have toxic skin secretions. And then just really quickly, some groups from shallow temperate waters. I'm only going to mention one, and that's the scorpion fishes. It includes some tropical members, but it also includes the rock fishes, which you can see in abundance here in the aquarium. There's nearly 100 species of these in the north temperate areas of the North Pacific. Very important commercial fisheries for these. The epipelagic zone is only 1% of the fishes, but some really characteristic ones like the tunas that are really fast swimming predatory fishes, obviously commercially important. Includes the bill fishes, which also are very fast swimmers. They grow really quickly, surprisingly quickly. Small individuals are hard to come by in collections. You either get little tiny ones or great big ones. But these also support commercial fisheries. And then there's a number of jacks that are in the epipelagic zone, such as this rooster fish, the mahi-mahi, the cobia, which is closely related to the remoras, which have this unusual feature, a modified dorsal fin that actually allows it to stick to other organisms for movement through the water column. Really quite an unusual group. And then with all those predators in the epipelagic zone, the smaller fishes in the area have to have unusual adaptations to escape predation. And one of the most striking ones are the flying fishes, which don't fly, but they actually glide. They have enlarged pectoral and, in some cases, pelvic fins. And what they do is they're being chased by a predator. They swim really quickly and leave the water and glide for distances to try to avoid the predator. Deep pelagic, I have to mention these because the Scripps collection is one of the largest collections of deep sea fishes in the world. It includes the lantern fishes, the mctophids, which are important predators, or planktivorous predators in this zone, and actually some species migrate towards the surface at night and back down into deeper water, so making a nice connection between those two ecosystems. Also includes the hatchet fishes. These are deep-bodied, laterally compressed fishes, very unusual morphology. And then some predators in the mesopelagic zone include the barbel dragon fishes. It's a lineage of incredibly diverse morphological fishes that have a variety of just extraordinary adaptations to predation in the deep sea, including luminous tissue on barbels and then light organs that actually apparently illuminate potential prey items in front of them. But nearly 300 species of these guys. There's some, believe it or not, some pelagic eels that don't sit on the bottom, but this is one of the most elegant ones. The witch eels and snipe eels, or this is a mesopelagic fish that actually never gets to the bottom, quite commonly caught in mesopelagic nets. And related to the eels are these really bizarre fishes, the saccopharyngiforms, which are somewhat damaged. It's hard to get one of these up that's in good shape, but they have these huge jaws with a big gaping branchial region for swallowing very, very large prey. One of the most unusual vertebrates in the world, actually. And then I can't leave the deep sea without talking about the deep sea angler fishes. They're actually related to a group of shallow water angler fishes called the Lophiiformes. And this whole group is characterized by a modified dorsal fin spine. So the regular dorsal fin is back here, but this is a little modified spine that's up on the snout, and it has a lure on the tip. And the shallow water groups use this as a visual display to attract potential prey, and when they wiggle it and a fish swims up, they swallow them. The deep sea representatives of this group have the same structure, an esca it's called, but on the tip of the esca is a little bulb that has a bioluminescent bacteria in it, and it's thought that they actually flash this over their mouth to attract potential prey items. Big teeth, big branchial cavity for swallowing large prey. Also an unusual group because of their reproduction. They have parasitic males in some species that actually, once they find a female, they latch on and don't let go. Really great group. And we're almost done here. So the deep benthic group, about 6%, a good 2,000 species, not as well studied as many of these other more charismatic groups. But one group that is well studied, largely by our Tomio Iwamoto, one of our colleagues at the Cal Academy of Sciences, are the Mercurids or grenadiers. And this is a worldwide group. They're really common on soft substrates of the deep sea and continental shelf and continental slope. So I could have shown you 500 different families, but I spared you that. But I don't spare my class that quite as much, unfortunately. And I'm sure some of them are here and they can tell you. We just had our final exam last week. But we were faced again with this issue of like how to convey this extraordinary diversity to students and to the general public as well. And you guys probably all know, if you paid any attention to fishes, there's lots of regional guides, like this wonderful reef fish guide series by Paul Human and Ned Deloach. This is one for the Caribbean area. But these books tend to sort of not cover, they describe the local fish fauna and species composition very well, but they don't really put it in the context of global diversity. There are a few guides, like this guide to surgeon fishes of the world for specific groups, but these are not very common either. And the one book that does do what we mimicked is Nelson's Fishes of the World. This is basically an encyclopedia of fish diversity. It's now in its fourth edition, but it covers all of the families, all 515 families, but it's just really dense. It has lots of really useful information, but it's not well illustrated. I mean, you can't illustrate that many fishes effectively. I should say, though, that this book was really, really important for us in compiling our book, which is Fishes, A Guide to Their Diversity. This book covers all 82 orders and about 150 of the 500-plus families in the world. I have to mention my co-authors. One of them, H.J. Walker, is here. H.J.'s a senior museum scientist at SIO. He's been that for 35 years or so. So he's really quite an expert in this area of marine fishes globally. And then my second co-author was Grant Gallen, who was my graduate student here, who currently works for the Pew Charitable Trust in Washington, D.C. So with that, I should thank a number of people. Also, would like to publicly thank the SIO Director's Office for their continued support of not only the academic side of Scripps, but also the oceanographic collections, which are really instrumental to this work. And then, of course, our families provided quite a bit of support and were quite patient on those long weekends.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.